Okay. Thank you, Eric. As you say, this is not general relativity. This is special relativity. Everyone here at the lab, at least the physicists, I guess, anyway, use special relativity inherently every day, every working day. I don't think the secretaries really care, but that's another issue. But I do feel that it's worthwhile to go back and check the basics. So that's what this talk is about, the basics. Because special relativity is really the foundation of every fundamental theory of physics that we have today. And if you want to believe that our theories are correct, you'd better check their foundations. And so that's one of the things I'm going to talk about today. But recently, in the past, oh, 5 or 6 years or so, the quest for quantum gravity has come up to a point where people have some at least vague notions of what quantum gravity might be, and they all imply that special relativity should be broken at the Planck scale or, you know, extremely high energies that are far beyond our current dreams. So one of the points is we have to know how well special relativity works, because if we can test it well enough, even at the energies that are accessible to us, maybe we can get some hints and understanding of what's going on in at the very small Planck scale that will tell us, or at least give us hints and guide us into a real theory of quantum gravity. So the outline of my talk today, I will start with an overview of the current experimental tests. Michelson and Morley are, of course, the first one that people think of as tests, and I will describe that and some others. I will take a look at some experiments that appear to refute special relativity. In class, your professor probably never told you about any of these experiments. I'm going to. Some of these experiments had a clear violation, especially the one from Dayton Miller, had a clear violation of special relativity. He found the ether. He knows. He determined the absolute motion of the Earth, and it happens to be about there right now. And I will explain how he came to that answer, why he came to that conclusion, and also why it doesn't refute special relativity at all. And at the end, I will give a very brief glimpse at the future about why special relativity is important today and why it might not be a symmetry of nature. So there are lots and lots of predictions of just special relativity. For instance, the speed of light should be isotropic, space should be isotropic, the speed of light should be constant, and so forth. And there are huge numbers. The number after this is how many experiments I have found that have tested that aspect of relativity. And of course, there's a real challenge here. Whenever you see an aspect that has not been tested, it's a challenge to the experimenter. Figure out how to do a test of length contraction. Now, I don't know how you can do it, because at normal speeds, you need a measurement accuracy of something like 1 part in 10 to the 12th. And that's very difficult to do, which I think is why there are no tests. Things like comparing the differential cross sections between a fixed target experiment and an intersecting beams experiment is put in relativistic kinematics. That's in interpreting the solid angles and all, you need to use length contraction, and you can sort of wave your hands and claim that's a test of length contraction, but I think really it's more a test of kinematics. And of course, there are a number of those. The isotropy of the speed of light is well tested. That's Michelson and Morley. There are a bunch of laser and maser tests that are far more accurate in atomic beams. There was a very neat frequency doubling interferometer that one of the, I would call him cranks perhaps, one of the people who really disbelieves special relativity. What he did is he started with a single laser beam, sent it out, and used frequency doubling crystals at the ends to come back, and he then interfered the doubled beam and looked at the variation in fringe shifts as he rotated the whole apparatus. His original explanation was, this is a one-way experiment because the two frequency doubled beams only come one way. Okay? Of course, when you think about it, it's really a two-way experiment because the light did go out and come back, and the fact that it changed frequency out at the outer ends did not affect that. Now I left my pointer. Here it is. So, and in any case, he got the null result, which surprised him and didn't surprise anyone else. Okay. There are some true one-way tests. One of the neat ones for that was by an Italian named Cialdia. He took two lasers, put them on a rotating table, and combined their beams this way. So the lasers are pointed one way, the beam goes the other way, and then he just put a photo tube at the end and measured the resulting interference between them, and then rotated the whole thing. And he has one of the smallest limits on the one-way speed of light, the one-way being from this mirror at this laser to this mirror at the other laser. And he has a limit of about 0.2 meters per second on the variation of the speed of light with angle, which is, you know, out of 300 million meters per second, that's a pretty accurate experiment. So the granddaddy of them all, the Michelson-Morley experiment. Of course, you know it from the textbooks. They took a light source, threw a beam splitter, and had two round-trip light beams that were then recombined at the very same beam splitter, and then the observer looked at it. The observer walked around the table as the thing rotated in the laboratory and measured with a vernier dial where the fringes were as it was rotating. It rotated much slower than I showed there. Okay? They rotated it about 2.5 minutes per turn. Okay? This is a very finicky experiment, however. My estimates for the accuracy with which the air in the arms has to be held constant is about 0.002 degrees centigrade, wrong C. And you need mechanical stability less than a wavelength, of course, because if the mirrors vibrate as you rotate, that'll change your fringe shifts too. So they did not have a tremendously accurate experiment, but they did put an upper limit of about 7.5 kilometers per second. That's relative to the ether, which was the theory that they were testing at the time. And we'll come back to this later, and I will actually show you some of their data and why it's interesting. A much more modern experiment is Brillat and Hall. This is from 1979. By that time, they had lasers, but this is a single mode laser. I don't know if you know the difference, but the ordinary laser you get from Edmund Scientific is by no means a single mode laser. It generally has about 5 optical modes in the beam. I'm talking longitudinal modes, and the result is that its coherence length is a handful of centimeters. By careful techniques, which I won't go into here, they could reduce the line width so that the coherence length is more like 20 meters rather than 5 centimeters. They took two of these. One of them was at rest in their lab, and the other one they mounted on a rotating table, and they slaved it to a Fabry-Perot interferometer, which is just two parallel plates, and the light bounces back and forth. And when it's high finesse, what that means is it makes a lot of bounces back and forth, so it effectively has a much longer length than the part between the mirrors. And of course, the rotating table did rotate. This time, this is about the right speed. They were rotating between 2 and 4 seconds per turn. Okay? This experiment is vastly less finicky for many reasons. Part of it is, of course, they're a century later, and technology, just bare machining technology and stuff like that is much better. But they also designed it in a very different way with components that Michelson and Morley never had. Invar it was used for all the parts that could vary with temperature. The Fabry-Perot etalon that's determining the actual frequency of the rotating laser, that's in vacuum. So you don't need to worry about whether your air is changing its density with temperature and thus its index of refraction and all. Okay? But the big one is it uses frequency rather than wavelength. And that gives them a much higher accuracy. They're about 1 part in 10 to the 15th. Where Michelson and Morley might have seen one fringe moving once per second, That's 1 part in 10 to the 15th to Brillouin Hall. So their result is very much better, and they're around 20 kilometers per second, or 20 meters per second. One of the other predictions of special relativity, of course, is that the speed of light is c, regardless of how the source is moving. Well, the simplest way to think about that is imagine that the observed speed of light will be c plus some constant times the velocity of the source, and we're going to try and use the experiments to determine k. So k is presumably somewhere between 0 and 1. At CERN, they tested pi 0 decay. Of course, a pi naught decays into a pair of gammas, and what they did is they just put gamma counters downstream at carefully known places, and they measured the time of flight from the production target to the gammas, and they required 2 gammas and that it be a pi naught and all that, but the ultimate thing was just time of flight over about 20 meters. And they put a limit of around 10 to the minus 4th on k. But astronomers know all sorts of things that a lot of us physicists don't know, and one of the things they have is these supernovas that they can see in distant galaxies and just enormous distances away. So the key thing about a supernova is, though, that it's bright for a day or a few days, and then it fades away. That's how they identify them. And all the light from the supernova gets to us within a few days of each other. But you can look at the Doppler broadening of that light, and you can know that the different emitting parts of that supernova are moving plus and minus 10,000 kilometers a second. Some of it's going away from us, some of it's coming towards us, of course some is going to the sides too. But the point is, you can use this to put a limit of k, because all that light got here within 10 days, and it's traveled 5 billion light years. So that gives a k of about 10 to the minus 9th. And this is one of the better limits on possible violations of special relativity. There's also, of course, relativistic kinematics. That's the thing that we all know and love around here. Practically every experiment here has relativity involved in it in one way or another. Unfortunately, that's been the case for many decades. So one of the points of testing relativistic kinematics is you have to look at the old experiments. Modern physicists use special relativity. They don't test it anymore. So, for instance, in 1939, they showed that the kinetic energy of electrons agrees with the prediction of special relativity to about 1%, and this is to speeds up to about 0.9 times the speed of light. Another newer but still old experiment was a review article in 1991 that used a series of experiments to put a constraint on the Lorentz limiting speed of particles and compared it to light. The key experiment happened in 1972, so this is a rather old analysis anyway. And they found that about 12 parts per million was the error bar they could put on the limiting speed being equal to the speed of light. Another way to test special relativity is look at experiments that were designed to measure something else, but you can interpret them. So for instance, the Super Kamiokande neutrino oscillation observations were used to put a difference of about 1 part in 10 to the 24th on the speed difference between the muon neutrino and the tau neutrino. Now this is from their atmospheric neutrinos, and they're coming at moderately large energies, so even with the masses that the neutrino oscillations are implying, they're still equal to c to high accuracy. And I have a few more examples of this. This is a rather old experiment directly testing kinematics. If you step back to Newtonian mechanics for a moment, you'll recall that if you have two equal mass objects and one of them at rest and one of them moves and they collide, no matter what angle the resultants come out at, the angles between them will be a right angle. This is a well-known, solid prediction of Newtonian kinematics. Akerlof et al. at the old CGS at Argonne, we're measuring proton-proton elastic scattering, and you can see the two arms of their spectrometer are nowhere near 90 degrees in the lab. Okay, in fact, they're 47 degrees. And in addition to just the bare testing of the angles between them, they also measured the momenta and all, and they tested the overall conservation of floor momentum to about 0.5% here. Another interesting one is the Los Alamos LSMD experiment. Now they have a neutrino oscillation experiment that, or result rather, that has not really been confirmed yet. But one of the things they did is they looked at the variation over a sidereal day, and there's no significant variance there, at least to my eye. So that's an expression that in the neutrino sector here, the orientation of the apparatus doesn't matter, and that's isotropy of space, one of the predictions of special relativity. There are a bunch of really neat high-resolution experiments that people have done recently. There's been kind of a renaissance in testing of special relativity lately. As I say, quantum gravity and notions about it imply this could be interesting, and so people have taken a new look at how can I really accurately test special relativity. Kostolecki at Indiana has come up with an extension to the standard model that includes Lorentz violating terms in all the different sectors of the standard model. So there are a gazillion free parameters. We'll have lots of fun making lots of experiments to test all those different parameters and put limits on them. But all of these recent experiments are very clever because in order to test at very high accuracy, and I'm talking 10 to the 9th to 10 to the 36th accuracies, to do that you have to beat down your systematic errors and you have to enhance the signal or sensitivity that you're looking for. So these can be really quite clever. One that I never would have thought of, and what they did is they got an Avogadro's number of aligned electron spins. And they did it in such a way that they could get zero magnetization out of the whole thing. And so, because if there were non-zero magnetization, as you rotate it, the magnetization of the pendulum would interact with the magnetization of the Earth, and you'd see that space wasn't isotropic. So it was very important to get the net magnetic field of this pendulum be zero. And the way they did that is they mixed alnico and samarium cobalt. They have different magnetizations by roughly a factor of two, and what they could do is get in a higher permeability one, they got half as many spins aligned as in the other one. And so they put them in opposite directions so that they had more spins aligned than they had magnetization. The magnetization went around the pendulum. Remember, this is going to be a torsion pendulum, so they then suspend it with the magnetization going circular, and they then put it on a rotating turntable. Of course, they're on the rotating Earth, and of course, the sun rotates around the Earth, as we all know. So they can look for their systematic effects by making the spin of the turntable be different from the spin of the Earth and the spin of the sun. And this is just one of the most incredible results. The Lorentz violation parameter that it's measuring has been put, they put a limit of about 10 to the minus 36th on it. I mean, that's just phenomenal. And of course, the key is have an Avogadro's number or something. Unfortunately, for most of the experiments around here, that's only our targets, and we're not doing much fixed target work anymore. So Avogadro's number is just a dream here. Another one that shows to what extent people will go to test relativity now. They started with a very simple device, an electron-cooled ion storage ring. Now, any of you who have been involved in the electron cooling here know that that is by no means a simple device, but I just drew it as a couple lines here. That's a whole accelerator in its own, a okay? But what they did is on one of the straight sections, they then put some lasers. They're going to ultimately have two different lasers going both directions, both directions along here because they have a mirror at the end. So the first thing that they did is they started with a fixed laser, but it's not quite fixed. It's tunable with these detectors, and they use the detectors to tune it to a double resonance of the ions. So already it's complicated. There are three different excited states of the ions, and they had to make it so that the Doppler-shifted laser going one way hits one of those resonances, and the Doppler-shifted laser going the other way, it's the other one of those resonances. So this is quite a finicky and quite a tricky thing to do, but that's what they started. That's the start. That's what they did. Now, you can use that, and you can just monitor the laser frequency, and you could measure how well the prediction of special relativity is, because you know the time dilations and the Doppler shifting for the velocity, and you could make a test of special relativity, okay? And indeed, they did that about 3 or 4 years earlier than this, okay? What they found was that the line width of the lithium that they were using was their limit. So they decided to improve on that, and what they did is they added a tunable laser to it, and by letting the fixed laser completely saturate the resonance, when the tunable laser scans by, when it hits the frequency of the fixed laser, it drops because it can't excite any fluorescence from the ions, because at that frequency they're all busy resonating with the fixed laser. So they can measure that frequency, and now they can measure the difference. And they're limited only by the line width of the lasers rather than the line width of the resonance itself. And that gives them about another factor of 1,000. So the result is that their measurement divided by the prediction of special relativity, as I say, this is just simpler Doppler shifting, is 9/9 with about a 1 part in 10 to the 9th error. And the last one I'll talk about is, again, a very clever way of doing things. They put two different materials in a single maser cavity and excited the maser oscillations of both xenon and helium all at once. Now, they had to put it in about a 1.5 Gauss field to do this, and the frequency depends fairly strongly on the field. So what they did is they used the xenon resonance to stabilize the field, and they servoed their solenoid in their magnetic field to the xenon resonance and held it steady, and then they measured the helium resonance over 14 months. So, for instance, over one sidereal day, this is about the units here are 40 times 10 to the minus 3 radians, and there's noise in there, quite a lot, but there's at least no significant variance over the day. This is one particular run of 18 days, and again, the units here now are thousands of nanohertz. So they're measuring the frequency of the helium resonance to nanohertz, and this is the result. And their ultimate conclusion was the frequency varies with orientation is less than 30 parts in 10 to the 12th. So this is sort of getting the scale of how accurately you have to be in a state-of-the-art test of special relativity now. 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 12th, that one parameter was even 10 to the minus 36. So this is a very mature field, and it's very challenging to do something new. So when you think about that experiment to measure length contraction, think carefully. Now, science is, of course, science. It's not math and logic. And we can't prove that our theories are true. And one aspect of this is we can prove that they're false, because a single experimental result that is in C year in direct conflict with the predictions of a theory will show that theory to be false. So now I'm going to move out of the place that you learned in school and talk about some experiments that are claimed to refute special relativity. So the first one is pretty elementary, but a lot of people haven't seen it, so I thought I'd show it. This is anomalous dispersion in a medium. The group velocity can be greater than c. And people think that that violates special relativity because they think energy is transferred with the group velocity, and if the group velocity is faster than c, that's a violation. Well, I'm going to show you why that's not true. Excuse me for a moment while I set it up. In this plot, we have a number of small Fourier components moving to the right, and the white at the bottom is the sum. And there's the group velocity. Now, the white line, vertical lines are moving to the right at speed c. And all of the individual components here are moving slower than the speed of light, but the higher frequency ones, the purple, is moving faster than the low frequency ones, the red. And what you see is the group velocity here is indeed faster than c, and it's a simple interference phenomenon. When all of these happen to line up together, you get a group, and when they all cancel each other, you don't. Okay? So one of the things this little applet will let me do is close a shutter. So to the right, I've turned off, and now when the group approaches, I'm going to open that shutter and you'll see what happens. As the wave front, point with this, as the front of the individual waves moves to the right, so does the group, but the group can never go where the actual waves aren't. And so any attempt to use this to send a group faster than the speed of light is going to fail because the front edge of those individual waves is moving slower than c, and you can never get past it. In fact, I can reset it. In this mode, it has a higher dispersion here than before, and lo and behold, the group goes backwards. Okay? So this is not a violation of special relativity. To those of you viewing this on video, the URL for that applet is right there. The next thing I want to talk about is superluminal sources in astronomy. There are a number of things moving out there that appear to go faster than the speed of light. And again, I'll show that's not a violation of special relativity. Here's one of them. This is a gamma ray source observed in 1994. And By measuring the separation of these and using the known distance to the source, they conclude the angular separation of these times the distance is about 1.25 times the speed of light. Okay, and uncertainties in that number are very much smaller than the difference. Okay, but a simple illustration of this shows it's not a violation. What's really happening is one of them is coming very close to the line of sight with the Earth. Now, this drawing is grossly not to scale, but since it's coming closer to Earth, it takes less time for the light to get here. It's approaching Earth at almost the speed of light. And the result is that when you take this into account, the speed of that object is only 0.92 the speed of light. And again, it's not a violation of special relativity. Some people claim that Michelson and Morley actually did not have a null result. They had a real result. And so I think it's worth looking into that. Here is the data from their 1887 paper. They had two sets of data, one taken at noon, one taken in the evening. And they vary by about 0.03 fringe. If the 30 kilometer per second speed of the Earth corresponds to 0.4 fringes, and that's what they were looking for. So the original authors basically said, we can say that the speed of the Earth relative to the ether is no more than 7.5 kilometers per second. These are averages of three runs over 4 days. Now, to the modern eye, these are missing something crucial. There's no error bar here, all right? Well, it is an average of three runs. I don't know how to compute the correct error bar, but I do know how to compute a lower bound on it, because I can just take a histogram of the points that were averaged and deduce from that an error bar. And there they are. There is no significant signal here, okay? Moreover, by examining the histogram, I can also see that this is a systematic, it's not a statistical variation, it's systematic within there. And we'll come into that in just a minute when we talk about Miller's experiment. We'll see that very much in very much more detail. Question? Yes. Because it's a system. Okay, the question was, why did all the points lie within a small fraction of the error? And the answer is, it's a systematic error. It's not a statistical one. How did I compute to compute the error, I took for each data point, I took the value of the data point minus the mean. The means are the points plotted here. And I histogrammed that over all points for noon and separately over all points for the afternoon. By subtracting the mean, that removes any signal that there might be. And from that resulting histogram, you could see that the points were not statistically distributed in the histogram. All the earlier ones were on the left, all the later ones were on the right. And that means it's systematically scanned.